But now, of course, everybody is a little Goebbels, and everybody is a little Surkov, and everybody is a little McCarthy. And every time you share something on social media, you've actually become a propagandist of sorts.
Modern Russian propaganda rather seeks to undermine existing democracies and existing international institutions.
The things that keep me up at night these days are the ability to create a fake video and audio of a world leader saying, I've launched nuclear weapons against whomever.
I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light onto the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world. In the late 12th century, no army was feared more than the Mongol horde, Genghis Khan's ruthless and brutal warriors who conquered much of the world and built an empire. But part of the Mongol horde's success was attributed not to military might, but to deception and disinformation. For example, at night, when the horde set up camp around cities they were about to sack, soldiers were instructed to light 3 to 5 torches apiece, making it look like their army was much bigger than it actually was. Mounted cavalry units were also instructed to tie tree branches to the backs of their horses, so that as they rode toward an enemy army, the dust cloud would seem to indicate thousands more horsemen than there actually were. And finally, there were even suicide troops on horseback, named the Mangudai, who would ride into battles they couldn't possibly win, and then pretend to retreat, simply so the enemy would chase them, unknowingly getting drawn into a trap where the rest of the horde was waiting to slaughter them. It is, of course, a cliche to say that information is power. But it's also true. Knowing something that your enemy does not gives you a massive advantage. But on the flip side, getting your enemy to believe something that is not true also gives you a massive advantage. And that form of trickery, of convincing others to make decisions based on lies, is called disinformation. Today, we're going to look at the past, present, and future of disinformation. From World War II intelligence operations to Russian reality TV shows, to teenagers and troll farms spewing fake news, and finally to the looming dystopian future just over the horizon, where we're not going to be able to believe what we see with our own eyes. But before we look ahead, we're going to look back to one of the most audacious and bizarre acts of deception in human history. At 9:30 in the morning on April 30th, 1943, a fisherman just off the coast of southwest Spain discovered what seemed to be the body of a British soldier floating in the waves. The fisherman took the body back to the port city of Huelva and turned it over to the Spanish authorities. And to their delight, they discovered that a briefcase containing classified military documents was attached to the corpse by a metal chain. They couldn't believe their luck. What they didn't realize, though, was that they were setting in motion one of the most consequential disinformation campaigns in world history, an act of disinformation that arguably changed the course of World War II. During World War II, bodies of soldiers washed up on the shore all the time. It was a routine occurrence. But to understand why this body washed up on that shore on that day, we need to go all the way back to 1939. To take a look at the secret British intelligence document called the Trout Memo.
Now, you've got to remember the British ruling class in 1939. They like to put on their tweeds, they like to go to the riverbank, they shoot their stags up in the mountains of Scotland, they go stalking, and then they go on the riverbank and they do fly fishing. So this director of naval intelligence called Admiral Godfrey wrote something called the Trout Memo.
That's Dan Snow, a historian who also hosts the History Hit podcast. But all that fly fishing gave Admiral Godfrey an idea. In fly fishing, the fishermen must be patient. They need to deceive the fish, to lure it in, to make it take the bait. The Trout Memo suggested that British intelligence could save countless lives if it applied those same lessons to war. And in 1943, it came time to put the principles of the Trout Memo into action. The Allies were preparing a major invasion of Europe, starting with Italy. But Hitler was expecting that. And so the Allies needed to figure out a way to confuse Hitler, to misdirect him, to make him think that he should send reinforcements to the wrong place, and move defenses away from where the Allies actually intended to strike.
The plan was to invade Sicily in the summer of 1943, but Churchill and everyone else felt that was far too obvious. They were in Tunisia, short hop across to Sicily. They were very worried that the Germans and Italians were going to throw reinforcements into Sicily, make it a very difficult campaign.
But how can you convince Hitler that the obvious target is in fact the wrong one? That was the question that British intelligence and Churchill's advisors pondered as they simultaneously made preparations for the invasion. And finally, after lots of brainstorming and arguing, they came up with a plan codenamed Operation Mincemeat.
And it really is about the man who never was.
The idea was simple and devious. They would locate a corpse, dress him up as a pilot who had crashed and died at sea, and then place the corpse in just the right spot so they could be certain that he would wash up on shore and be discovered. Once the authorities searched his body, they would find fake documents, seemingly top secret documents that would be related to a decoy invasion far away from Sicily. And the idea was to have the body wash up on the shores of Spain, because the government there was known to share information with the Abwehr, the Nazi intelligence service. Of course, the British government couldn't exactly just pop down to the nearest morgue and snatch a body in the dead of night.
They actually had a huge problem getting a body, because it required the consent of families. There were laws, even in the middle of the Second World War in Britain.
And more than that, they also had to find the right kind of body. After all, if someone had died from an infection that left clear marks on their body, the Spanish authorities wouldn't ever believe that the man had died in a plane crash at sea. So, as they were puzzling out what to do, the perfect kind of body appeared in the London morgue.
The British got themselves a corpse. It happened to be the corpse of someone who was described as a tramp. He was living.
That man, Glyndwr Michael, was a penniless Welsh homeless man who, down on his luck, moved to London. And one night, in an abandoned warehouse near King's Cross Station, he ingested rat poison. Back then, rat poison often came in the form of a paste that was smeared across bread crusts. So there is a debate over whether Michael committed suicide or was just hungry and desperate. But either way, he fell ill from the poison and soon died. Crucially, both of his parents had already died, and he had no siblings, so there was no family that was going to come looking for him. And suddenly, it looked like British intelligence had found their body.
The pathologist assured them the rat poison would not show up in his system if he was given a proper autopsy.
But the intelligence officers wanted to be certain that the corpse was presented in just the right way, to maximize the chances that the Abwehr would take the bait. So they asked experts what the exact cause of death was likely to be if a pilot crashed into the sea.
The detail I love is that they asked, if you're in an air crash, how would you die? Would there need to be water in the lungs?
And of course, there wasn't any water in the homeless man's lungs because he had died completely dry in a warehouse.
But in the pathologist case, you know what? You usually die of shock rather than drowning. So you'd probably get away with no water in the lungs.
No family, no signs of trauma that were incompatible with dying in an air crash, and no need to artificially fill his lungs with water. They had their body. But they had it way too soon. It was late January in 1943, and the planned invasion of Sicily wasn't going to begin until that summer. The body wasn't going to last that long. So someone floated the idea of freezing the corpse.
They can't freeze him. You can tell if a body's been defrosted. So they just kept him in very, very cold conditions. They had a limited time horizon. And he was placed in a container with dry ice, which who knew? I did not know. But when it sublimates, it fills the canister with CO2, no oxygen, so it preserves the body for an extended period.
So time is of the essence, as they were able to slow but not stop the body's decomposition. And now the priority became making everything convincing, so that the Germans wouldn't see the corpse as the lure that it was. The first step was to give Glyndwr Michael a new name.
He was dressed as a Royal Marines officer. Captain William Martin was his name. Very common name. There were William Martins all over the Royal Marines at this time, so if anyone looked, it wouldn't be unusual. There'd be William Martins around that rank.
But in real life, people aren't just names and ranks. They have lives outside the army. And soldiers carry heirlooms of home, memories of what they've left behind as they go off to fight in wars. So the corpse needed that too.
They created a legend, you know, they created a backstory. And they filled him with pocket litter, as it was known, right? So you got a photo of his girlfriend, who was actually an MI5 clerk named Jean Leslie. It's a beautiful picture, actually. Two love letters from this imagined girlfriend and a receipt for a diamond ring.
Corpse? Check. Name and rank? Check. Fake sweetheart pining for him back home, waiting to get married? Check. But he still needed a uniform. And unexpectedly, the big problem wasn't the standard-issue shirt or the standard-issue trousers. It turned out the big problem was finding the right underwear. In those days, uniforms didn't come with underwear, and underwear was one of those many items that was being rationed by the British government. So nobody wanted to give theirs up. And you couldn't just slap on some low-quality underpants either. If you wanted to fool the enemy into thinking that they had found the body of an officer, well, he needed to be dressed like an officer, and that meant underpants befitting for his rank and station. The British government needed help, and it got it from somewhere that is normally known for its scholars rather than for its underwear collection, Oxford University. Oxford is divided up into 31 colleges. I, for example, did my PhD at New College, Oxford, which happens to be where Operation Mincemeat went next. For you see, the president or the warden of New College at the outbreak of World War II was a history professor of considerable means named H.A.L. Fisher. And as a man of considerable means, he had an underwear collection that would make any person of taste jealous. But of course, he needed all that underwear for himself. That is, until April 1940, when he was tragically hit by a bus and died. That was bad news for Fisher, of course, but it was very good news for British intelligence. They took a pair of Fisher's underwear, along with a vest and a pair of socks, and they got them ready to put on the corpse. And with the body looking the part, they moved on to other tricky questions, like how to make the fake plans look authentic, and how to ensure that those documents would survive even after floating in the sea.
They tested various inks, commercially available inks, to see which ones were most water resistant, because they knew this body was going to be submerged in water for some time. So they did all these tests with this ink, so the one least likely to smudge was the one they used.
Once they'd found the right ink, they had to figure out how to make sure the documents wouldn't just float away.
Handcuffed to him was a briefcase containing some letters.
They chose letters because they thought those would be the most plausible given the circumstances.
There's a real art form to convincing foreign intelligence operatives that this is for real. They thought, hang on, it can't be encrypted. It would have gone by diplomatic bag if it was top secret, so all that kind of stuff. So it had to be like a personal letter that this guy could conceivably have been carrying as a courier.
Those letters were carefully written to seem as authentic as possible, full of petty complaints and gripes about the Americans. But there was still one problem. The Brits knew that they would likely get the corpse back or the documents back when the Spanish government had discovered the body. So they needed to be sure that the letter had been read, so they could be certain that the fake message had been intercepted. And to do so, they came up with an ingenious solution.
They put a single black eyelash in this letter, in this envelope, to check if it had been tampered with.
At that point, everything was ready. They just needed to put their plan in action. And for that, they needed the Prime Minister to give the final green light.
Churchill was briefed in pajamas, in his bed, in the cabinet war rooms, mid-April 1943. And then he said, go for it.
The corpse was secretly loaded onto a submarine called the HMS Seraph, with only the officers on the submarine aware of what the cargo really was. British intelligence wanted to minimize the number of people who knew about the disinformation campaign. So they told the crew something different.
So they were told they were carrying a meteorological instrument and they had to deliver it off the coast of Spain. I can't believe any of the crew believed that.
So the submarine moved silently into position, a position chosen by military scientists who had analyzed the tides and the wind patterns to ensure that the body would wash up just where they wanted it to.
They surfaced in the early hours of the 30th of April, 1943, and then the crew was sent below and the officers opened the cask and threw this body into the water. And one of the officers said a little sigh. He read a psalm. So that they kind of buried him at sea. Only 5 hours later, I think it was, 5 or 6 hours later, just after sunrise, the Spanish fishermen found him. He was taken to the Spanish authorities.
And then the Brits waited, so they could see if the Spanish authorities had taken the bait and passed the false intelligence on to the German Abwehr.
So the Spanish buried the body with full military honors, and they returned the briefcase to the British saying, oh, sorry, they gave it to the British, you know, the consul or ambassador or whatever. And he was like, thank you. And they said, no, of course we haven't looked inside. And they went, the Brits went inside, opened it up, opened the envelope, no eyelash. The envelope had been opened, had been tampered with.
So the question was, did it work?
Well, in the words of one officer that briefed the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, the Germans swallowed mincemeat, rod, line, and sinker.
Hitler moved several panzer tank divisions to Greece and the Balkans, convinced that the British were planning to strike there rather than in Sicily. And then, even when the invasion of Sicily began, Hitler kept defensive troops away, thinking that the invasion of Sicily was itself a ruse, and that the real invasion, the one mentioned in those letters planted on that homeless man's corpse, would come later, in Greece or the Balkans.
You know, in terms of intelligence coups, this one, I think it's fair to say, is up there.
Operation Mincemeat was an act of military deception, a type of disinformation that is used in warfare to fool the enemy into making mistakes. But it is a perfect illustration of just how powerful false information can be, causing empires to rise and fall, and these days causing democracies to tear themselves apart. And worst of all, as technology outpaces our ability to adapt to it and process it, the risks associated with disinformation campaigns are only growing. A 21st century version of Operation Mincemeat could be far more dangerous. And not all the applications of disinformation are related to military campaigns or warfare. So to understand disinformation more broadly, we need to look at the masters of it. The word disinformation comes from the Russian word dezinformatsiya. Some people mistakenly use disinformation and misinformation interchangeably, but they're not the same thing. Misinformation is an American word, one that refers to false or misleading information, but without any intention to deliberately deceive someone else. If you're misinformed, that just means that you believe something that happens to be untrue. Disinformation is different and more sinister. It's a word coined by the Soviet Communist Party. A former practitioner of Soviet disinformation, Ladislav Bittmann, formerly of the Czech Intelligence Service, defined it this way in a 1984 interview.
Disinformation is actually a deliberately distorted or manipulated information that is leaked into the communication system of the opponent with the expectation that it would be accepted as genuine information and influence either the decision-making process, for example, or to influence or manipulate public opinion.
The KGB and Soviet military intelligence, known as the GRU, both used sophisticated disinformation tactics. And part of the idea was that enemies, blinded by the lies spread by Soviet intelligence, would inflict damage on themselves, so that the Soviet Union could gravitate closer toward its foreign policy goals without the costly or risky endeavor of tanks rumbling into battle or even firing a single shot. The Soviets succeeded sometimes, and their tactics backfired other times. But disinformation wasn't enough to win the Cold War.
The Iron Curtain between East Germany and West Berlin has come tumbling down. East Germany announced today it is opening its borders, allowing its citizens to go anywhere they wish. The future of the Berlin Wall is now up in the air.
And after the Berlin Wall crumbled, the Soviet Union did too. And that meant that disinformation, like everything else, had to morph from a Soviet propaganda and foreign policy tool into a Russian one. But it also meant a complete change for people who were born in the Soviet Union and tried to come to terms with a modern Russia.
My name's Peter Pomerantsev.
Peter is a visiting senior fellow at the London School of Economics, but he was born in 1977 in the Soviet Union. And when Peter was a toddler, his family fled to West Germany. His father had been arrested by the KGB for spreading anti-Soviet literature. So they escaped the Iron Curtain and eventually made it to London, where they took advantage of their newfound freedom of expression. Peter's dad got a job working for the BBC World Service. Peter's mom made a documentary about Soviet gulags and later won a BAFTA, the British equivalent of the Oscars. But Peter still felt a certain pull towards Russia. And in 2001, he moved to Moscow to work in the film and television industry, giving him a unique insight into the world of Russian propaganda and mass media disinformation.
I suppose the interesting thing in my biography is that after university, I went to Russia. And after many adventures there, and having worked on sort of TV documentaries about Russia for Western channels, I then worked inside Russian media, actually the entertainment complex. So I helped make amusing and not so amusing reality shows. This was in the sort of the mid-2000s, and that led to an awareness of how media was being used in the Putin system and this kind of new kind of authoritarianism that was brewing in Russia.
Producing television shows in a heavily controlled authoritarian media environment was a particularly bizarre industry to work in at the time. Remember, Putin was a former KGB officer himself. He was well-versed in disinformation campaigns, and as Russia's president, he sought to consolidate power. And that meant broadly controlling information flows, manipulating public perceptions, right down to making sure that the television shows being aired at the time didn't upset the apple cart of his authoritarian order.
I never worked in the news myself, but there have been plenty of whistleblowers and plenty of people who've talked about it and also sort of like documentary evidence of how it works. Firstly, every Friday in my day, the heads of all the main TV channels would meet in the Kremlin with then the guy who was in charge of sort of media and politics, that was Vladislav Surkov back then. It's changed since then. And they literally would be told kind of the main agendas for the week and the main aims.
And then once they've been given the agenda items for the week, television producers would be given a bit of freedom to innovate, to be creative, so long as they generally stuck to the script favored by the Kremlin.
And then it's up to them, a bit like an improv theatre, to develop scenarios around that. There is plenty of evidence of what they call temniki, which are sort of like A4 graphs showing, you know, which stories are important and which conclusions people are meant to have from them. We also have evidence from the troll farms, where literally people who work in the troll farms are given articles that they will need to post under, comment under, and sort of the conclusions they're meant to draw. And there's a lot of creativity you can do around the edges. I mean, you're kind of given, you know, here's the story, here's what you're meant to express, but then it's up to you how you do it.
And so I asked Peter the obvious question. Was this the same thing as outright censorship?
It's not really censorship in that sense. There isn't a censor there. There are blacklists of people who aren't allowed on. But it's largely a game that people play along with.
And as you might expect, Russians realized this was happening. They understood the game. They knew the television networks had to play it if they wanted to stay on the air. It seemed completely normal that the news produced by the state would cheerlead for the state. In fact, what seemed totally alien, totally weird to Russians, was the notion that television programs could be free to criticize anyone they wanted to, as is the case in the West.
There's much less prejudice against the idea of this sort of state-directed propaganda. That was completely normal in Soviet times. Media is seen as an extension of the state, and its job is to implement what the state wants. That's not a subversive idea. Quite the opposite. The idea of media as the fourth estate is the subversive idea. And, you know, that's why so many Russians find it hard to believe, but why would you have a BBC? I mean, why? I mean, that's bizarre. Why would a country allow that? That's something that would criticize the state that's semi-funding it? I mean, what are you talking about? And they find our whole conception of media quite bizarre.
So this whole attitude toward media and television is really important to understand the next part of Peter's biography, when he began to produce reality TV shows in Russia. Because in Russia, reality wasn't an objective, tangible thing for many people. Some people took reality to mean whatever the Russian state or Putin said was true. And for others, the whole idea of reality or truth became warped and shaky, something you couldn't really be confident in because there were so many scripted lies floating about. And for those people, it gave a certain sense that nothing is true and everything is possible, which is the title of Peter's excellent book. Peter jumped into that world of distorted reality and tried to make a reality TV show called Hello Goodbye.
It was based in Domodedovo Airport. It's actually a Dutch show that was made in America and was being remade in Russia. It's very simple, people saying hello and goodbye in airports. So a lot of tears, a lot of laughter, a lot of natural raw emotion. We spent a lot of time getting the right characters. I mean, literally sometimes find two stories a week or three stories a week, even though you had a crew there permanently.
The show was well produced, the stories were gripping and emotional. And yet, even though the exact same show with the exact same format would go on to be a hit in Belgium, Canada, Colombia, the UK, and the US, Hello Goodbye flopped completely in Russia.
There were two things wrong with it for a Russian audience. Firstly, most Russians at that point still didn't fly. You know, they traveled between cities by train. And it was a little bit too much of an elite experience for a lot of Russians to really empathize with. But more importantly, a lot of people just didn't believe the stories were real. They assumed they were scripted, simply because so much of TV generally was scripted.
But even though Russians believed that reality TV was scripted, it had to be scripted in a believable fashion for it to be a hit. After all, it's hard to empathize with a storyline or a character if the whole premise seems absurdly fictional from the start. And that became a problem for some familiar reality TV shows that producers tried to introduce to the Russian airwaves.
If you were to switch on Russian TV, it would look just the same as American TV. Literally, it's the same shows a lot of the time.
Due to cultural differences, some shows that were hits in the US or the UK were dead on arrival in Russia.
When the Russians made The Apprentice, kind of they bought the rights, they had consultants over, which is the way it works, from the West, and they made The Apprentice. They had a great oligarch who was fronting it. He was much richer than Donald Trump. Good music, good storylines. Everything was very well made. Complete and utter flop. Because Russians do not believe that is how you make money. You don't make money by being a brilliant business mind. If you have a brilliant business mind in Russia, chances are you'll end up imprisoned or exiled for it. You make money by, you know, stealing money from the state, sleeping your way to the top, whatever. Certainly not like this. So they completely rejected the rules of the game.
But there were other reality shows that did really well in Russia. Survivor, for example, which puts people through immense hardship, was a hit.
Because in the country of the gulag, of horrible weather, they completely got that premise that, you know, people being made to suffer, that just worked.
The interesting thing here is that when reality is scripted, facts become malleable. The line between what is true and what is false blurs, which is one of the main aims of disinformation campaigns. Some people will believe Vladimir Putin. Some people won't trust Putin or state media. But many of those same people will also start to question facts more generally. Their sense of reality will dim. Those people who can't really tell for sure what is real and what is scripted in their lives are much easier to control. And in that quasi-dystopian world, facts aren't really meaningful anymore.
But once you leave a paradigm where there is an aim to achieve, a sort of a rationally grounded aim, then why would you need facts? You're not trying to prove anything anymore. What's interesting about the Kremlin today doesn't bother trying to prove anything rational. It's very anarchic in its nature. The truth that it has, a kind of emotional, make Russia great again, which is something that Putin's been running on since 1999. In that sense, Trump is just catching up.
And we will make America great again.
And for that, you don't really need sort of, you know, rational proofs. You just need information events, which give you this kind of the soap opera and drama of making Russia look and feel big and strong. But there's no clear articulated ideal that you're striving towards.
And in that regard, the soap opera drama that Putin's regime orchestrates on Russian national television is a sort of form of domestic disinformation campaign, complete with fake characters playing roles, even as everyone pretends that the charade is real. And nowhere is that more clear than in the nightly spectacle of the political debating shows, as the handpicked characters create the mirage of democracy.
Then you see debating shows in Russia as well, which were really, really good, much more interesting than British debating shows. I mean, they were almost like Jerry Springer talk shows meet debating shows. And you'd have some sort of like, you know, fat, sweating, red-faced communist and some very effete, drippy liberal and some sweary-mouthed right-wing nationalist all kind of like accusing each other of various things. And if you switch it on, you say, what a healthy and robust democracy. And it takes you a while to realize that actually all these parties are either simply created by the Kremlin, but definitely directed by the Kremlin, and have their niches very, very carefully kind of distributed by the Kremlin. And essentially, that this is a bit of a puppet show, whose one message is there is no alternative to Putin. You're meant to watch this and say, well, for most people, look at all these freaks, Putin is so much better.
In a way, this is sort of like the logic of Operation Mincemeat, except instead of a fake pilot's body, you have fake alternatives to Vladimir Putin. But it can be very effective at causing ordinary Russians to lose their appetite for democracy if the alternatives seem so unpalatable.
This was known as managed democracy, which is sort of like taking democracy and sucking it of any democratic content.
In other words, it's not democracy at all. It's authoritarianism. Across the globe, despots and dictators use disinformation as a means to keep their people under control. Vladimir Putin just happens to be pretty good at it.
The people around him are a mix of sort of marketing PR people and KGB people. So definitely the sort of, a lot of the levers of powers are all about sort of arresting people and intimidating them and finding dirt on them and co-opting them the way a KGB agent is trained to do. But then a lot of it is really from the opposite world, the world of PR and marketing. It's quite a demonic combination if you think about it.
And that demonic combination can be used to test Russians, to see how loyal they really are to Vladimir Putin. Are they willing to play along with a constructed reality that they suspect isn't true? It's a tactic that's evolved from the Soviet days, when they would focus on what they called the big lie.
The Soviet Union as the ultimate civilization, Nazi Germany as a superior culture, which could be scientifically proven to be better than other cultures, and science had to be falsified in order to make this true.
That's Anne Applebaum, a Washington Post columnist, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, and a professor of practice at the London School of Economics, where she directs a research program on disinformation and 21st century propaganda. Not exactly an underachiever. But she argues that the big lie from the Soviet era has been replaced with something new.
Nowadays, softer, lower-level authoritarian regimes don't need these big lies, but they very often rely on medium-sized lies, fantasies or myths or particular stories that the leadership remains invested in and which they then use both to drag people into a system of falsehood, but also to gauge who in society is loyal to them and who not. So if you believe something, if you profess publicly to believe in something which is clearly not true or which is even ludicrous on the face of it, then the leadership knows you are loyal. And you can see this working in countries like Russia.
But beyond loyalty tests, Putin's disinformation can be aimed at asserting his own power.
It may also be that he is using the lies as a way of showing how powerful he is. Look, I can lie. I can tell this obviously false story, and no harm comes to me. And that intimidates people into believing him and obeying him in the future. Look, this is a man who can control reality.
Sometimes that assertion of power is obviously a lie. But those lies can still be useful because they confuse some people. For example, the lies Putin told after Kremlin agents tried to murder a Russian national in the English town of Salisbury were ridiculous.
Ничего там особенного криминального нет.
So Putin's experience is that a blatant lie, even saying that the two killers who came to Britain to murder people in Salisbury were selling sports products, I mean, it's patently absurd, but it will convince a few people, it will confuse other people, it might serve to confuse people inside Russia, and that will help Putin get through this difficult period.
And that confusion can be useful for Russian foreign policy. Just as the Kremlin told blatant lies as Russian soldiers entered eastern Ukraine, starting in 2014.
Remember that Putin invaded Crimea. We had Russian troops marching across Crimea. We had film of them. We saw them doing it. And yet the Russian government kept insisting they had nothing to do with it. You know, these were volunteers. They bought their equipment at local shops. We have no idea who they are. And actually, for a significant period of time, the West and even the Ukrainians were confused. And the lie served to create a level of confusion, a level of uncertainty that allowed the Russians to finish that operation.
Of course, Putin doesn't just use disinformation to disorient his own population or to provide cover for his own military operations. He's exporting it too, hoping to cause chaos in the West.
What we're really talking about, the phenomenon that is damaging to democracy and the phenomenon that is new and the phenomenon that is enhanced by social media, is really malign influence campaigns. Soviet propaganda sought to convince people that the Soviet Union was a superior civilization. Modern Russian propaganda does not try to convince anybody that Russia is better. Modern Russian propaganda rather seeks to undermine existing democracies and existing international institutions.
That's where all the stuff from the 2016 elections comes into play. The stuff we've all heard about Russian efforts to sway the American election in favor of Trump or to sway the Brexit referendum in favor of Britain, leaving the European Union. Much of the Kremlin's disinformation is aimed at creating chaos in the Western world by blurring the line between fact and fiction.
It's really about people conducting campaigns designed to manipulate public opinion.
And some countries seem to be more resilient to those campaigns than others.
You know, you can almost look at countries which are better at it than others. And they tend to be countries where you have people unified around a national purpose. I mean, for example, in the Baltic states are pretty good at understanding and identifying Russian disinformation. Sweden is pretty good at identifying and understanding Russian disinformation.
Others, not so much.
The countries that find it most difficult are ones like the United States, where you have a great many different people in different groups which are acting in contradiction against one another. And then it's much easier for people who are peddling disinformation to play on those disagreements and to play on those divisions.
And unfortunately, that vulnerability didn't just occur to Vladimir Putin. Sure, a lot of the disinformation that your friends or family are sharing on Facebook did come from fake news troll farms in Siberia, filled with agents trying to deceive Americans while sowing discord. But that same strategy has also occurred to other state and non-state actors too, including some shadowy figures and some opportunistic ones, who have realized that spreading disinformation can be a big moneymaker. So where does much of that disinformation come from?
The answer is Veles, a small town in central Macedonia. For Macedonian millennials, it's a digital gold rush.
How much money do they make?
Yeah, there are some people who make like 200k or something like that.
200,000 euros?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're kidding?
Yeah, no, I'm not joking. It's true.
That's from an investigative report from Channel 4 News in the UK. News agencies across the globe latched onto the narrative that teenagers in Veles were writing up outlandish and disgusting reports, like the false idea that Michelle Obama is actually a man, to make a bit of spending cash, a disinformation side hustle. In one instance, one teenager spoke about how he was able to buy a guitar from the proceeds of his disinformation business. But as you might expect, that was only part of the story.
So I'm Sashka Cvetkovska. I'm working at the Independent Investigative NGO from Macedonia Investigative Reporting Lab, which is part of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project.
She works with a team that tries to shine a light into some of the darker corners of the world, where corruption and impropriety are common, and where people will go to great lengths to hide their nefarious behavior.
What we mostly do is we follow corruption, we follow the money, and usually every time when we see propaganda, it's about money.
And after a bit of digging in Macedonia, Saskia and her team realized that the hundreds of fake news websites set up in the little town of Veles were not spontaneous, and they were not simply launched by apolitical teens.
But what we know so far and what was interesting is that this was not a story about some poor kids inventing a new model how to earn money. That was a very naive narrative.
But figuring out who was actually behind them was tricky.
You can buy a domain, you can pay $15 or $20, stay anonymous and do whatever you want to do.
And that regulatory environment meant that Veles was a bit like the internet's version of the Wild West.
So basically, the global leadership is allowing some forces to operate in the gray.
And that gray area, it turned out, was incredibly lucrative.
We found a source who preferred to stay anonymous and who said that in the weeks before the elections and after the elections, people were cashing on daily basis checks as high as $50,000, and we are talking per day.
The team at OCCRP realized that this wasn't just some entrepreneurial teenagers. This was far too organized. So their investigation finally led them to one man named Tale Arsov, a Macedonian lawyer who was actively coordinating with a few opportunistic Americans as they set up extraordinarily influential websites that masqueraded as news outlets, but were actually hives of disinformation. And Tale was the queen bee.
Tale was running the number one, the most successful website, usapoliticstoday.com.
Those website names were deliberately intended to dupe people into thinking they were legitimate, to look like the real thing, so that when someone shared an article from them on Facebook, it would pass the smell test from someone who wasn't careful enough to read behind the headline and check the veracity of the claims. And there are ongoing investigations to see if there are any Russian links to the Veles sites that Tale Arsov launched, to see whether he was an opportunistic freelancer or a cog in a much bigger machine. Right now, it's still unclear. But if you're interested, I highly recommend reading the OCCRP report, which you can find by Googling the secret players behind Macedonia's fake news sites. But the problem that their investigative report highlights is obvious. If teenagers could be involved in a disinformation operation, the barrier to entry is much, much lower than it was in the Soviet days.
All of this is pretty easy. It's pretty cheap. It's not actually high tech.
And if anyone would know, it's Anne Applebaum, because she was targeted by a disinformation campaign online a few years ago.
I was the target of a Russian disinformation campaign in 2014 after the invasion of Ukraine. It was very peculiar. It was started by an Australian-born journalist who lives in Moscow and who was actually in the United States working in Washington in the 1980s. And he wrote a series of articles about me, essentially implying that my coverage of Ukraine was somehow suspicious, that my source of financing is suspicious and so on. And I saw the articles. They appeared on a kind of neutral-looking Russian website that looked like it was mostly to do with Russian business. And I then followed them as they were repeated and posted around the internet. And at first I was very unnerved by it because it's always weird to see fake stories about yourself circulating. And then actually I'm now sort of rather grateful to that journalist for this particular incident, because this was how I learned how it works. You create a story which has some real facts in it and some fake ones. They're sort of mixed up. It looks like a legitimate story. It's then passed around in what I realized was a kind of clear network of European websites that do exactly this kind of thing.
And so the question that I'm sure you're all asking is, how do we fix this? Can we close Pandora's box now that it's been opened?
The hard thing conceptually is that there's not going to be one silver bullet. It's going to be a combination of the social media companies changing their formula and acting differently and understanding how important this is. It's going to be governments. It's going to come from NGOs. It's going to come from things like media literacy campaigns that schools and others will do. And in a way, as people begin to understand how this works, then some of the antibodies to it, I think, will exist. But it may last a very long time. It may be a while before we reach some new equilibrium. We're really only at the beginning of this problem.
That sober assessment is, I think, unfortunately correct. Because the technology to create disinformation campaigns is advancing faster than ever. Up until now, when you saw a video of Angela Merkel or Theresa May or George W. Bush saying something, you knew it was real. But unfortunately, we're about to lose that certainty.
I didn't eat breakfast, so here we are on a rainy... they always ask what I had for breakfast, and I never know how to answer that. I guess I can just make something. I had a bagel with cream cheese. It was delicious. I am Hani Farid. I am a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College.
He's one of the world's leading experts in digital forensics, and some of his research is related to trying to figure out whether media content, be it audio or photos or video, has been doctored.
We've been manipulating images and videos and audios for as long as we've been recording them.
But the technology has gotten much better. There was a video floating around recently in which President Obama called President Trump a, quote, complete dipshit. Of course, President Obama never said that. But in the video, it really looks like he said that. His mouth moves in perfect time. His head tilts naturally. And yet, the entire video is faked. A collaboration between BuzzFeed Video and the actor Jordan Peele to warn everyone that a new technology is coming.
That was really good. It was not perfect, but it was highly compelling. And if you looked at it just very quickly, it looked like it was the president talking. And I think that was the canary in the coal mine in some ways. That was telling us this is coming now.
The name for that new technology that can create those convincing videos is deepfakes.
What the deep part of deepfake refers to is a mechanism for creating this fake content, and in particular, deep neural networks. Deep neural networks are a computational technique in the machine learning, artificial intelligence community that has taken root over the last few years, very exciting innovations that are coming from these very sophisticated learning algorithms. And they have also been turned, and what I think some people would consider slightly nefarious, but not always nefarious purposes, for the creation of fake images, fake video, and fake audio.
That technology makes it far easier to manipulate digital video in convincing ways. And that's a big difference from the Soviet past, when Stalin would erase so-called undesirables from photos in order to erase them from history.
So historically, when you looked at photo manipulation, video manipulation, let's go pre-digital, let's go Stalin, there was really just a handful of people in the world that could do this well. It required a huge amount of skill. You were in the dark room. You were literally painting on negatives and re-exposing. You had to have sophisticated equipment just to record the content in the first place, let alone manipulate it. Now fast forward into the digital age, and so the game changer here with the deep fakes is that the machine is doing all the heavy lifting. And we've essentially automated the creation of the fake. So what the machine is being told to do and then taught to do is to, for example, replace this person's face with another person's face in a video and then do that over a 5-minute video clip so it looks like it's a different person. And the person, the individual creating that fake, is requiring less and less skill to pull off more and more sophisticated fakery. And that, in many ways, is the game changer here. It's not the ability to create fake content. We've always been able to do that. It's that we've democratized access to what used to be a relatively small club of people who can create highly compelling, sophisticated video and audio fakes of world leaders.
It's not hard to see how dangerous that could be. Imagine an embarrassing bombshell video of a candidate, from their past perhaps, released the day before an election. Enough time for everyone to hear about it, but perhaps not enough time for it to be debunked as a fake. That world isn't the vision of a futuristic dystopia from science fiction. It's imminent. And the worst-case scenario is much darker.
The things that keep me up at night these days are the ability to create a fake video and audio of a world leader saying, I've launched nuclear weapons against whomever. And that's, you know what, a 10-second video. I think the technology to create that exists today. We have the mechanism to distribute it through YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, whatever. And given the speed at which everything works and the consequences of that, you can imagine some very bad things happening before anybody figures out that it's fake. I would say within another 18 to 24 months, the technology is going to get to a point where the human brain may not be able to decipher it.
Of course, creating fake content is dangerous in itself, particularly when world leaders could be involved. But it's also a threat to our sense of reality or truth, and with that, it threatens the concept of accountability.
But in some ways, I think the larger threat is just the knowledge that we can create this fake content, because then everybody has plausible deniability and everybody has skepticism. So anytime a video comes out that is damning or embarrassing, the person depicted can say, look, it's fake. And suddenly we have a world where how do we sort out what's real? Because if it is in fact the case that almost anything can be faked, well, then nothing is real.
Of course, when fake content is created, it's the job of journalists to determine whether it is real or not before reporting it. But in the modern world, a lot of seemingly newsworthy content gets beamed across the globe before it can be verified.
Frankly, one of the biggest problems right now in the fake news phenomenon is that people get their news on Facebook. That's a ridiculous place to get your news. Stop doing that.
Yeah, please stop doing that. It's not responsible. But in some countries, being responsible is easier said than done, because turning off Facebook is virtually the same thing as unplugging from the internet.
So Facebook has penetrated into developing countries, and what they have done is struck deals with the internet service providers so that the use on their platform doesn't cost consumers money. And so Facebook is synonymous with the internet. That is the internet. And so when all of your information is being funneled through this one corporate entity whose interests are not necessarily aligned with yours or society's.
For him, the longstanding mantra of tech companies like Facebook, move fast and break things, is socially irresponsible and is threatening the very foundation of democracy.
If there was any other industry whose catchphrase was move fast and break things, we would think, what's wrong with you? Would you fly with an airline that said move fast and break things?
And yet, we're all sort of stuck on that flight, so to speak, because social media has become an inescapable part of modern life. So aside from regulating tech companies, which we obviously should do more, how can you stop deepfakes from doing damage? If sophisticated software is being used to create the fakes, can't we use even more sophisticated software to detect them in real time? And it turns out the answer is yes. But that for such a model to work, your algorithm would have to be perfect. 99% accuracy wouldn't cut it.
The scale of the internet is insane. On YouTube, there's between 400 and 500 hours of video uploaded every minute. On Facebook, there are billions of uploads every day. And so to work at internet scale, your algorithms have to be spectacularly accurate. I mean, if you're at 99% accuracy, which is really, really good, one in 100 mistakes, you're dead in the water on the internet at internet scale.
So if the retroactive authentication seems either impossible or impractical, perhaps content can be verified genuine when it's created, before it leaves your camera or your phone and goes out into cyberspace.
There are some companies developing what are called secure imaging pipelines. So these are now different types of camera apps that at the point of recording authenticate the content. And they cryptographically sign the content. They put it on the blockchain, a distributed ledger that is very, very hard, if not impossible, to manipulate. And then that allows anybody after the fact to authenticate.
It's still not a silver bullet. Because when it comes to combating disinformation, there are no silver bullets. But it's important for our societies to take the threat seriously. Because disinformation is getting cheaper. It's getting easier. It's getting better. We're careening towards a world in which you can choose your own reality and find the content, fake or real, to back up your worldview. And that's not just bad for Thanksgiving dinners with your crazy uncle who said the moon landing was fake. It's bad for democracy. Democracy requires a shared sense of reality. And that, now more than ever, is splintering. Our leaders have an obligation to fix it rather than adding fuel to the fire.
They are the fake, fake, disgusting news.
But we also have a responsibility to demand that our leaders tell the truth, to consume information that we know is verified, fact-checked, and real, and to only spread content on social media channels that reflects reality. Because until we do that, our democracies will be like the Germans in 1943, heading toward disaster because we are basing our decisions on lies and disinformation. Thanks for listening. Subscribe now and please rate the show on whatever platform you use to get your podcasts. It really helps other people find out about the show. Next episode, we look at ransom.
On the flatbed, we're about 12 guys with Kalashnikovs. And this technical stopped our car, aimed that cannon through the windshield, and overpowered my armed guard.
What's it like to be held as a hostage by Somali pirates for 977 days? How does economic game theory help explain the prices that are paid to release hostages? How does being held in a dark basement for 6 years affect your family life after you're free? And is it better to pay ransoms or to never negotiate with kidnappers? We're going to find out. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Theme music by Scott Holmes, and additional music by Lee Rosever. Goodbye for now.